Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. How you doing tonight? We have got some really surprising stuff for you tonight. The first thing we're going to do is I want to bring out our wonderful political commentator, the charming, the talented Miss Brooke Hines. Brooke, no fanfare music tonight, unfortunately. But you're still the nitty-gritty girl for me.
As always.
It's a thrill of it right here in live web radio.
That's right. Well, it's great to be here. Today is actually a special day for me because, let's see, it's November the 5th, and this marks the first time I've published an article at the Florida Squeeze since July, I think. I've taken an extended vacation from publishing articles, and a lot of that's just been me being tired of repeating myself and writing the same column over and over again. So when the news of Donna Brazile's new book hit earlier this week, or I guess it was on Thursday or Friday, and Politico published the extended excerpt from her book, I just immediately knew that I had to respond to this because there's a new wrinkle. I believe that this changes the political playing field somewhat, and we're no longer in the position of having to repeat the same messages in the same situation again. I think something has changed now that Donna Brazile has come to the fore. And what Donna Brazile has done, the name of the piece, by the way, that I put up, is Brazil fundraising agreement sold out DNC to Clinton campaign. And in the piece, I do a callback to the second part of my DNC fraud lawsuit series. And in that second part of the DNC fraud lawsuit series, I called out joint fundraising agreements specifically as the mechanism by which the DNC was becoming corrupted. And what gave me a heads up to that was the manner in which the lawyer for the DNC was responding to questioning by the judge in the hearing, the hearing for the DNC fraud lawsuit in the move to dismiss. And this is the one big piece of material that we have from the DNC fraud lawsuit, where you had just like a ton of back and forth between the lawyers and the judge. And I thought at the time, reading the transcript, that the lawyer for the DNC was playing a really odd game of chicken with the judge. And I couldn't understand why he was doing it. So I started digging into every angle that I could find that they were talking about. And what I found was that there was a fundraising agreements that were impacting the way that the DNC interacted with the Hillary Clinton campaign. Specifically, there was an entity called Hillary Victory Fund, which was also represented by the same law firm and the same lead counsel as was carrying the DNC fraud lawsuit. So Perkins Coie, which is the name of the law firm that has that was arguing the DNC fraud lawsuit, they also rep the Hillary Victory Fund, which is one of the biggest pieces so far that has come out of Donna Brazile's new book, Hacks. And so, you know, just to make a big splash, the first thing we hear about her book is that she, sometime in September during the general election, Donna Brazile was trying to get answers for Bernie Sanders. She claims that she had no idea what was going on during the primaries. This is before anybody knew that she had stolen questions during the primary debates. and given them to the Hillary campaign. So in September, she was telling Bernie Sanders that she would try to get to the bottom of things and find out if the primary were rigged and somehow, or if there was some preference being shown to the Clinton campaign. So she digs and she digs and she digs, and she can't believe it, but lo and behold, there are these things called joint fundraising agreements that were signed a year before the election back in 2015, that essentially handed over control of the DNC to Hillary Clinton's campaign headquarters in Brooklyn. I mean, I'm being very specific. It wasn't just the Hillary campaign and Hillary's at the helm. It was very specific people who were running the campaign out of the headquarters located in Brooklyn, which also happens to be the same place that 200,000 voters were purged from the voter rolls on the day of the primary, just in the borough of Brooklyn. Just coincidentally, just thought I'd bring that up as a, just as an aside, just sidebar there. So, Donna Brazile's taking a lot of heat today, and it looks like the entire staff of Clinton campaign headquarters has signed this letter pushing back on Donna Brazile and saying, "Oh, we're so proud of the campaign that we had a part of." And at the very end of the letter that was signed by, like, I don't know, 100 people, it says, "Finally, we are pretty tired." Oh, this was written by Palmieri, by the way, one of the big comms people. "Finally, we are pretty tired of people who were not part of our campaign telling the world what it was like to be on the inside of our campaign and how we felt about it." And so what they're doing is they're throwing shade on Donna Brazile, saying, oh, she doesn't know what she was talking about because she wasn't inside enough to know what was really going on in our campaign. But, you know, if you think about that for just 2 seconds, if the chair of the DNC does not know what's going on in the presidential campaign in the year that it's happening, then there is a major problem. That person needs to be intimately involved in that campaign. They need to be considered a part of that campaign. There should be no distance between once they're in the general, there should be no distance between the two. You know, but this is general. This is a general kind of, muscling around and bullying that political operatives, you'll see amongst political operatives all the time. And it's just so transparent that it's kind of gobsmacking that professionals of that stature, you know, not that the people on the Hillary Clinton campaign in Brooklyn were like the best people, best political operatives in the world, but they have a certain stature. It just seems like this is a fairly low blow to go ask Donna Brazile with. So Donna Brazile, in her very extensive excerpt that was published in Politico, told all kinds of tales out of school. And she wants everyone to know that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, number one, Debbie Wasserman Schultz was a very bad manager. And Debbie Wasserman Schultz is mentioned throughout all of this. And let me just say, as an aside, if anybody comes out of this mess smelling like a rose, it's got to be Tim Canova. Tim Canova needs to learn how to pick up the pieces around that district and win this race. Because Debbie Wasserman Schultz at this point, with what's going on with these allegations with Donna Brazile, between that and the Awan brothers and the whole cloud of corruption around her, I can't imagine a ham sandwich should be able to win against Debbie Wasserman Schultz at this point. Donna Brazile goes on to throw shade at Barack Obama, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, everybody in the Brooklyn headquarters. It's an amazing, it's almost like a slam book. It's almost like a high school slam book. One of the things she says right off the bat is that Barack Obama's neglect had left the party in significant debt. And then as Hillary's campaign gained momentum, money wasn't coming back into the DNC. It wasn't coming back into the party. Now, that's significant. And I mention this in my article that I published today at the Florida Squeeze, because I believe, and I believe that my research from my previous article, having to do with the DNC fraud lawsuit, I think that the research shows that the organization that we know as the DNC prefers to operate in an environment of debt, because when they operate in an environment of debt, that means that they have to make deals with big money donors in order to move ahead. And so it's very easy. It's a win-win situation. If the way that you want to raise money is to just hop on a plane and get off in Martha's Vineyard and then get back in the plane and go back to your townhouse in Georgetown, if that's the route you're going to take to do your fundraising, party you're going to have is the kind of party that loses elections to Donald Trump. It's the kind of party that produces candidates like Hillary Clinton that runs her campaign the way that she did. And there, I discuss this in my article as well. We are continuing, instead of fixing this problem, we are, by every indication, continuing to do the same thing. In fact, Tom Perez, responding to the article in Politico, the new chair of the DNC, or co-chair, Tom Perez, put out a statement rebutting a good deal of what Donna Brazile had to say. And he also said that they have no intention of ending joint fundraising agreements. And as a matter of fact, while we're talking about it, I would like to introduce you to our new and improved joint fundraising agreement. I believe it's the Democrats' new grassroots victory fund, the Democrats' grassroots victory fund. That's what it's called. So it's got grassroots in the name. So you know it's grassroots.
So it's legit.
It's totally legit, man. There's not going to be any Wall Street in there at all, right? So, you know, everything here is dirty, right? And the fact that Donna Brazile is telling these tales out of school, you know, I'm thankful for that. You know, I'm glad somebody's coming forward and discussing the abuse that we've all witnessed for so long. Now we can all talk about it like adults, you know. We're not all acting like, you know, the adult children of alcoholics or something. We can talk about it openly. But the fact is that she's still lying. Donna Brazile is still lying, because when she says that she, in September, had to go rooting around to find the real story and what was really going on behind the scenes and who was really doing the campaign, that stretches credulity to the limit. That is beyond belief. I can't believe anybody would say that to somebody else with a straight face. I don't believe anybody who ran the DNC could say that to somebody with a straight face. What she's alleging is that the Hillary Clinton campaign was running the DNC soup to nuts. Their data, their analytics, their communications, you couldn't sign a check without headquarters signing off on it. And so it was news to her in September that all of this was going on. That just doesn't add up, you know? What she's done, if anybody's watched Stranger Things, what she's doing here is she's watering down the truth. She's watering down the truth to an extent that people can take it. And I think that if she came right out and said, like, I'm a political operative, I'm a professional, and of course I knew this from the very beginning, everybody would be like, what? And you wouldn't be able to understand the story. You wouldn't be able to pay any attention to it. She's having to water it down, and she's having to spin this narrative in a way so that, you know, people can kind of catch up and stay with her. And, you know, she's telling a story that we can understand and that is half of the story rather than the whole story, where we would just be like, that's too unreal. As a matter of fact, today on, I think it was Stephanopoulos' show, she referred to Seth Rich and mentioned that that after Seth Rich was murdered, that she was paranoid that people would come after her, which I find to be a very forward and ill-advised, I guess, thing to say on network television, that this person, that so many people think that there is a conspiracy by the Clinton murder incorporated cabal to take him out because they knew that he was the leaker of the DNC emails, to suggest that he was murdered in a way that also put her at risk is gobsmacking. Why would she say that? If she has more information on that case, she needs to come forward. Otherwise, we need to know why it is she would say that on network television. On Stephanopoulos' show. So how are you feeling about this, Rick?
Well, you know, I've heard so many excuses and so many roundabouts, but you're right. To basically say you're in fear of your life for talking while simultaneously bearing the dirty laundry is certainly an interesting stretch of, I'm going to call it political twister, because one doesn't do A while doing B. It just seems amazingly counterintuitive. And I understand that the Democratic Party, for whatever it is, it certainly isn't Trump. And I totally am sympathetic to those who say, look, you know, let's keep our eye on the prize. Let's remember we're against Trump. Okay, being against Trump, that's a good thing to be. But the thing is, if you're against Trump while simultaneously sabotaging the electorate, coming out saying that you have not a Democratic, writ small, bone in your body, and that you'll do anything, anytime to anybody, and as you say, you know, I've heard it suggested that, well, you know, she's covered. She's a pundit now. She can say whatever she wants, and it's a shame that she's savaging Clinton. But hey, you know, politics will be politics. Well, the thing is, if they are in fact not going to hand it over to the Republicans and either Trump or what's after Trump in the Republican Party, they have to have not just a face, but an actual agenda. And you would think that with the driving off a cliff agenda the Republicans have turned to again and again and again and again, that they could come up with something. That Chucky, if he's such a leader, and Nancy, if she's such a leader, would be standing in the middle of the street going, we disagree, and here's what we would do. Now, the fact that they're not doing that, you know, I mean, call me a cynic, but it seems to me to suggest that they don't really have any other plan other than feathering their own nest. And you know, that's a pretty pass. So you say, okay, who's the second tier? Well, the second tier, let's pretend it's the progressive wing of Congress. Well, okay. Our good Senator Warren, who is not a perfect political being, certainly has plenty of weird agendas things, an imperfect person, but maybe she's at least ready to stand up. Who's standing up? Who, with the Republicans in such terrible disarray, savaging each other left and right, assuming that they'd all go to jail. And of course, no one imagines there's a stomach for that in Mueller's wildest fever dream. But let's just say a handful of leaders go down, that somebody notices that Mr. McConnell, who earns 100 grand a year, somehow managed to accumulate 12 million. I don't know. Sounds funny to me. There's such room for attention on this crummy, criminal Republican cabal. The fact that we haven't come up with a coherent strategy, it certainly isn't the problem of the rank and file. It certainly isn't the problem of the grassroots. And, you know, those guys can ignore us at their peril. But I think it's beyond pathetic that They even let the Republican case, you know, I mean, look, no one, you know, and I know, no one really who knows anything about the media assumes that they're in the pocket of the left. But with the media narrative that, well, all the other Democrats have, the only thing they got going is they're against Trump. Well, they're not Trump. Okay, shouldn't you wear that as a badge? Given the incredible, insane judgment of this guy, shouldn't not being for Trump's agenda be enough? It is for me.
So, because I think that, let me unpack this for you. What you're doing, because you're a thoughtful person, is you're taking that let's be against Trump and you're placing it within an ideology that makes sense to you. And you have an ideology that probably goes something like we should do what is required of us to leave the earth a better place, to clean up our messes, and to do justice, and, you know, so on and so forth. That kind of stuff. That's an ideology, that life should be fair and that we live in a democracy. That's ideology. People like Schumer and Pelosi and, political operatives, they don't live in a world of ideology. They live in a world of tactics and strategies. It's a totally different world, and they don't understand it. And they're a completely different breed, by the way, than Republican operatives who completely live in a world of ideology. And so as progressives, we look over at the Republicans and the right wing, and we're like, you know what? They've kind of got their shit together because they're all the time, you know, talking about the things that fires up their base and talking, and they speak in the language that rank and file voters, not donors, but voters, can understand and relate to, and they talk about things that move them. So our leaders, we're at a place that reminds me a lot of 1992. Remember 1992 when when it was George W. Bush, when it was Poppy, and he was looking kind of weak, and presidential election, and the Blue Dogs came along, and, you know, we had the outrageously wild primary with Bill Clinton. And I remember that there was a conscious shift at the time where folks were saying, sure, you know, these new Dems, these Blue Dogs don't have a lot of ideology, but what they do have is the ability to beat Republicans at their own game. And so a lot of FDR Dems and Kennedy Catholic Dems, like my family, were willing to go along with it because they were like, we just lived through 8 years of Reagan and 4 years of Poppy Bush, and we can't take anymore. So they were willing to do whatever it took to, you know, to get a Democrat in the White House and to start winning again. And let me remind our listeners, this was at a time when Democrats still had majorities in the Congress. And so we consciously made that choice. We consciously set aside ideology. We consciously said, well, you know, we're going to triangulate things now, and we're going to win on a playing field on which we can win. And while we were doing that, while we thought we were being also smart, we were actually getting done all of the things that the Republicans wanted done while they changed their strategy back to ideology. And they started moving all of their voters back to the polls by talking about the things that moved their voters in their heart. And they went right back to the heartland and did all of that. And we kept moving further and further and further away from that. Now, Obama came along and kind of made it sound – Obama made neoliberalism sound like an ideology that people could get behind. He made centrism just sound like something that everybody wanted a piece of, where – Washington, D.C. could be a place where people put aside their differences and we work together and get stuff done, and nobody tries to get one up on the other one. And that's just not the world we live in. I mean, we had hope that maybe he could make things happen, and he was much more attractive than Hillary Clinton, I thought, in 2008. But still, we're talking about a candidate who got into the White House pretty much talking about no ideology. You know, just, you know, we've got hope and change, and, you know, I'm a neoliberal, and we're all neoliberals now, and it's all about strategy and tactics, and we're just going to go and do the work. We're at a place where we need to change that. That's not working. That didn't work for Hillary Clinton, and it was totally working for Donald Trump, and it was totally working for Bernie Sanders. So we need to learn that lesson and get back to basics on that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, let me ask you this. You know, we've got, on the one hand, we've got the Donna Brazile issue with the Democrats. The other thing is that the Republicans are proposing this crazy millionaire, billionaire giveaway. And I'm sure you heard the statement with as much incredulity as I did when they said that, well, the middle class makes roughly $450,000 a year. Did you hear that?
I didn't hear it this time around, but I've actually heard that in other contexts. And yeah, that's that's what some people think.
Well, you wonder what their paycheck is, because
right,
you know,
that's, they think that they're middle class.
Oh,
you know,
oh,
I see. Senators who make $400,000 a year think that they're middle class. That's what they think. They think they're regular Joes.
What do you think explains the absolute silence from the Democrats in the face of these Republican floating their trial balloons? Why aren't they shooting? I don't get it.
Well, that's kind of scary, because there are, I'm sure, Democrats who want to vote for that thing. You know, I'm sure that we have Joe Lieberman Democrats in this Congress that would really like for that tax cut to go through, because it would make their donors pretty dang happy. You know, you don't see the reason why you don't see Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and all the rest out there, you know, pounding the lectern about how evil and terrible this is because they don't think that it's evil and terrible. They would really like to see some, you know, to see their donors get some goodies, and they'd like to claim some, you know, claim that as a win, I am sure. But the way that politics is played, they can't do that. You know, they can't, Democrats can't go out and say, well, we're going to give political cover to, you know, Joe Manchin, who's probably going to vote for this, or, you know, this dude from, let's say, Montana, you know, congressman from Montana or whatever, you know, these stray, you know, heartland Democrats that might peel off. What's her name from Missouri with the red glasses? Her name escapes me.
McCaskill.
Yeah. You know, these red Democrats who very often vote against the economic interests of the middle class and vote against the economic interests of you know, progressives in the party, they would love to vote for something like that. You know, they think that they need that in order to stay, in order for them to keep their seats. You know, there's all different kinds of pressures that get put on individual women and people in the Senate, you know, people across the country. And I would actually be surprised if the Democrats keep the whole party together through that vote. I would be very surprised. I am not expecting the House Democrats to stay united on that at all.
Well,
the Senate Democrats,
certainly,
I think, will stay united. And I think that if this gets defeated, it will get defeated in the Senate.
Well, you know, I sure wish we would be hearing from some Democratic leader out there who says that this is madness. It's a complete giveaway to the right and to the rich, and we can't stand this. This will not stand. While at the same time, we've got a president who said, look, it doesn't matter that the State Department has a for sale sign on it, that there's no one in this ambassadorship or that ambassadorship. Doesn't matter at all, because after all, you've got me, and I'm the best thing you got going. Well, holy smokes.
Well, let me tell you, this is why Bernie Sanders is the most popular politician in the United States. Because if you go to his Twitter feed, almost everything he talks about is the tax cut. He is completely leading on this, you know, that Trump has repeatedly reneged on his promises by supporting the wealthy at the expense of working families. That's one tweet. And another is, we won't be distracted from your efforts to give billionaires tax cuts, take health care from millions, and deny climate change. Do your job. And that's tweeting at Donald Trump. And then she just goes on and on and on. You know, he is out there leading on this because it's his brand. And I can't think, other than Elizabeth Warren and maybe Ro Khanna, I can't think of anyone else who's it's their brand to get out in front of these economic issues.
Well, you know, I want to oppose Trump every way I possibly can. But, you know, if all they're offering is Republican light, no one is going to get behind it. You know, are they trying to force a third party? You know, do they really want a parliamentary style situation? And, well, you know, all right, let's turn for just a second. Where is the Democratic Party? Can you tell where they are on the Mueller investigation? Are they just hanging fire, hoping that you know, this tar baby is going to grab all these bad guys and they're going to walk away? I mean, you know, they're going to be the only ones left on the field? Have you heard anything said by these guys other than, well, we're going to wait and see what happens? Well, no shit, Sherlock.
It's worse than that. I think that there are a lot of Democrats, not non-people in Congress, not our leaders, but there are a lot of Democrats just out in the wilderness, you know, and people in the media, I think, who are feeding this, that if Mueller's investigation results in criminal charges and Trump has to resign, people are of the illusion, they're under the illusion that that means that Hillary then gets to be president. Like it's some kind of, like, you know, sports thing where the ball gets thrown back into the game and the other team goes on the field or something weird like that. But that's not going to happen. You know, there's no, it doesn't seem to me, and I'm agreeing with you, it doesn't seem to me like there's any strategy beyond what could happen with the Mueller investigation, and that the strategy for now is just to keep yelling Russia and to cripple Trump, which is, you know, not a bad idea. I say cripple Trump in every way possible. And, you know, if Russia is successful doing it, then fine. And, you know, if there's something else that comes along that seems to work, try that too. Just keep him occupied. Give him things to do or something where he's not breaking things. I think that's the approach we should take. But, you know, the Democrats, for a party that is completely motivated by strategy and tactics, it's not clear to me at all what their strategy is beyond this Mueller investigation, because all we're seeing is tactics being brought to bear with regard to possible criminal charges, a possible impeachment, you know, definitely if any of this happens, a major crisis, possibly a constitutional crisis. I mean, there's all different ways that this could go bad, and I don't see there being much strategy. I see there just being a lot of tactics. And worse than that, I'm just seeing social media tactics. I'm just seeing this, like, stuff on the surface. So, you know, hopefully, hopefully we're wrong, and hopefully we're not seeing what's going on behind the scenes. Hopefully there really are, you know, serious people doing serious things and making plans. But I don't see it. And honestly, I think it'd be a Pyrrhic victory for Trump to be removed from office and for the United States to wind up with a President Pence. I honestly think that Pence could do more damage than Trump is doing right now, and that's saying a lot. You know, he's been a disaster already, but Pence would be a more organized disaster. He'd be more like the apocalypse.
Well, you know, I of course, like many progressives who, you know, are paying attention to this government, you know, we greet with great relish, you know, the third lie he's been caught at, you know, before Congress. And, you know, if any kind of justice will be told, you know, he's in a bad way. But you and I know that justice, how did Dr. King Jr. put it? The arc of justice ultimately gets there, but it sometimes takes the long way around.
The arc of justice is loopy these days, I think, is the way that should be updated.
And okay, we must, I think, also mention that there's been another shooting, and Americans are out there fully armed and ready to kill each other. And as the stress gets ramped up, it's only going to get worse. If you have an extra couple minutes, I'd like to play. We're having all kinds of trouble with the interface, but I was able to find one of the six pieces I uploaded today. And it's a little piece about the recent Democratic conference that my friendly robot reads. It's reading it on behalf of Rob Abston, who is not a robot, but this robot is standing in for him on a little essay he wrote. It's about a 5-minuter here. And I'd like you to stick around while I play it, because I think I'd like to get you to comment on it. And all right, Let's see here. I had it a minute ago. It's a boy, I'll tell you, the interface is loop-de-loop today. Oh, come on. It was there, and then it's gone. No, that's the healthcare spot. Okay, come on now. Let me ask you this. You didn't go. What did you hear about the recent Democratic conference in Orlando, wasn't it?
Yes, it was in Orlando, and I didn't go this year. I've gone in years past. I heard that they did things a little bit differently this year, that they had the body voting on kind of a quasi-platform and voting on it en masse. Some people weren't too happy with the way that came together, and some people were very happy to see the return of some semblance of a real convention where people have where delegates actually have a say in what happens within the Democratic Party. And just as a, you know, just a little bit of history, way back in the 70s, the Florida Democratic Conventions were run a lot like the National Democratic Conventions, and there were platforms, and people argued, and thoughts were had, and actions were taken. And then they stopped doing that, and the convention became more of like a collection of clubs and caucus meetings and trainings and expensive dinners. And so this year was the first year that they were returning to some semblance of having the body of delegates vote on stuff. And when they voted, they voted down two very important planks of the platform, which was, and I believe the way that this happened, is that the executive committee, there was a smaller body, that winnowed everything down, and then the entire body of delegates votes en masse for the whole thing, thumbs up, thumbs down. But two pieces that didn't get into the platform was ending superdelegates and a preference for open primaries. So those things didn't make it in. But what did make it in was a whole bunch of progressive policy preferences that have never been talked about at, you know, Florida Democratic organizational, you know, gatherings before. I mean, you know, stuff like Medicare for All and you know, the $15 minimum wage and all of, you know, all of the stuff that progressive activists and social justice folks have been talking about now for years. Finally, the Florida Democratic Party is on board, and I think that the at least in my mind, the piece about failing to turn down superdelegates and failing to state a preference for open primaries kind of overshadowed a lot of the other progressive policy approaches that they elevated, and they really need to be. And the Florida Democratic Party really needs to be appreciated for taking the steps that they've taken this year, and that was a really good step that they took.
Well, it seems that a file that was visible a few minutes ago doesn't seem to be visible now. Gosh.
Blog Talk Radio might be having some funny business go on. They might be updating their software. For our listeners at home, when I logged in earlier today to create the show, I noticed that it was acting a little glitchy. So I just say that.
Yeah,
so
well, it's actually acting real glitchy right now. Let me try one last thing to see if I can get the problem solved by going another route. And let's see if that helps any. Basically, folks, for those of you listening out there, every interview that I uploaded today is invisible. And I can go in the inventory and it says it's there, but in the studio where one plays these things, they are just not home. And that means that I can't share with you these incredible interviews. We have a wonderful interview with Aria Ligia. Well, there we go. One of them is now visible. Okay, let me try playing this. Let me see if I got Rob's little piece here. Okay,
that's
not visible. But I do have Wendy's up. So thank you so much, Brooke. I really appreciate you coming out. You really pulled both through for me. And I will talk to you next week, okay? We'll wish us both better luck next week. Thank you.
Sounds good. See you then.
Okay, bye-bye. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm speaking to Professor Wendy Lynn Lee of Bloomington University, and we're going to talk a little bit about the America in 2017 as we approach the inauguration and anti-inauguration the next president. And we've already kind of seen what the Republicans have planned for. And then, of course, we've watched them crash and burn right out of the box. So you know, there is help and hope in other spells, as the old saying goes. So tell me, Professor, when you've got a party that is got the presidency, got the Supreme Court, got the House and the Senate, and the first thing they do is put their foot in their mouth and then shoot it, what do you think about a party like that?
I think that hubris can come back to haunt one in ways that are both amusing and telling, quite informative. I would disagree with the claim that they necessarily have the Supreme Court. Okay. That will require more votes in the Senate. And I think that at least in the Senate, if the Democrats have the will, which is always a kind of open question for me, the Republicans could actually have a real fight on their hands with respect to any Supreme Court nominee that they put up, but particularly if they put up what I think we all expect, which will be someone to the very far right of both Antonin Scalia and Attila the Hun.
Yeah. I'm picturing a Mike Huckabee kind of fellow, you know, someone cosmopolitan
Hopefully simply smarter, at least than that. I don't take Huckabee. I saw him, I think it was on Sean Hannity for the 45 seconds I could withstand before throwing up in my mouth a little bit. And I actually find him both insufferable and, as I'm just kind of willing to call it as it is right now,
sure.
Just simply stupid. Just dumb. He's just dumb.
Yeah. I hear you. I wouldn't disagree in the least little bit. Well, see, I'm maybe a little sadder on the Supreme Court side of things. I honestly think that Schumer is going to fold like a cheap suit. I think he's got too much vested interest in the
PNC
in New York, and I don't think he's. I look at that guy.
You could be right.
I don't see a man who's prepared to fight for principle.
You could very well be right. Schumer's a player, and there are reasons why Schumer and Bernie Sanders have quite a wary relationship with one another, and that is because Sanders is simply a more honest, dignified man, and Schumer is a player.
Yeah.
So, no, you could be right. I just think among the battles that the Democrats could choose and could at least gain some traction, the Supreme Court battle is an area where they could gain some traction. But as I said, it's going to be a matter of political will, and they need to show that the unity that I saw displayed today is not merely, as you put it, a cheap suit, not merely a facade.
I predicted early on that I'm usually pretty resistant to touting my own horn, but I predicted early on that these guys would fight among themselves to an extent that would benefit those of us who don't quite have their vision of the future. I take endless solace in this right out of the box, let's gut the ethics committee, only to have their obviously ethically challenged, certainly morally compromised Donald Trump leader call him on it. You know, I think, I mean, if there is a less likely scenario of Republican infighting, I can't imagine it.
I think we want to keep this in perspective, though, because Donald Trump didn't call them on it because for any ethical reason.
Oh, no, I agree.
Donald Trump, I mean, let's not accuse him of having any kind of moral compass of any sort. He does not. He called him on it because he recognized, however dimly, and that too is surprising in Donald Trump, but I think he recognized that it was politically stupid, that it was a politically stupid thing to be doing out the gate. And for Donald Trump to recognize even that much, you know, it's like I have to give him a begrudging thumbs up on that one. At least he got that far. He won't get any further, though.
No, I agree completely.
And it won't matter.
And I
won't matter. Right.
I made the same point in a posting this morning. I said, yeah, here's a guy who refuses to divest, who thinks of government as a family business, who's basically prepared to double deal all the way, never showed his tax records, refuses to divest, is comfortable requesting sexual service from anybody passing by, offers to the world while he's running for president that he could go shoot someone and it wouldn't make a whit of difference. And this guy is troubled by their ethics.
and as I'd say, I don't think he is in any way troubled by their ethics.
Right.
I just think he wants to have as smooth a coronation on the 19th as possible. And he's going to do everything that he has to do in order to ensure that his ascendancy to God is unimpeded, is without obstacle.
You know, I'm wondering if this is Gambit 1, what's the final position? Completely failed.
Well, I mean, I think we saw a little bit of, you know, Coming Attractions. We had a little preview of Coming Attractions today. When I watched